morning. Thank you so much for joining us. Whenever you're joining us, one of the great things here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z and all the shows brought to you by Progressive Radio Network is that there is a really active archive, and you can find a lot of shows if you go to naturalnurse.com and radio shows. We have archives there, and then prn.fm. They have archives of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, as well as many of the other fantastic shows that they have there. And I want to tell you about some up-and-coming events, because we love you to join us. And you can email us at naturalnurse.com, send an email, or Facebook The Natural Nurse, or Natural Alternatives Education YouTube channel. We have many different places you can get in touch with us. But I want to tell you about some of the classes that you can actually get CE credits for if you're a health professional, such as an RN, an NP, an RD, an LMT, so licensed massage therapists, registered dietitians, clinical nutritionists, nurses. Also, we have lots of classes for DCs, doctors of chiropractic, NDs, naturopathic physicians. And all of these classes are open for those who are professionals who need CE credits, but also they're open for anyone. You just don't need the CE credits, but you still can get the knowledge for your own information and verification, and you're welcome to join us. So if you go to naturalnurse.com calendar, you will see many of the up-and-coming classes. For instance, herbs and dowsing. That is a fascinating topic where you actually can learn to determine by using dowsing techniques for yourself or for your loved ones, or if you are a practitioner, really, even if you're using pharmaceuticals to tell you the truth, how do you decide? And certainly if you're using herbs or natural therapies, how do you decide for an individual, yourself or others, and you want to use a particular herb, how much, when, for how long, etc.? How do you decide dosing? Because many people are just guessing. And what's horrible in mainstream medicine is that the dosage recommendations are often identical regardless of the individual. And that is criminal. As a nurse, I was recently working in a hospital and I saw an 80-year-old woman who weighed about 75 pounds getting the exact same drug in the exact same dose as the person who was in, you know, the bed across the hall, who was a 250-pound, 50-year-old man. Now tell me, how can that make sense? It doesn't. But when we learn dowsing, that is one tool. And by the way, there's all kinds of fancy electronic instrumentation that you can use, but a very simple dowsing technique can help you discover how you can be in charge of your health and really do much more accurate dosing. So that's coming up pretty soon. We also have one on herbal manufacturing, legal considerations. That is huge because so many people make at-home herbal remedies and then they sell them. Well, if you just do that to your friends and family, okay. The minute you put something online, you are considered a manufacturer. And I'm talking about Etsy. I have five people who got bopped on Etsy, like within the last few weeks, for selling herbal remedies that are not being made according to GMP. And the individuals thought that they didn't apply to them, but it does. And if you want to fight with the FDA, then go ahead and make herbal arts and craftsy remedies, tinctures, etc., and put them on Etsy and see how much fun you're going to have and how much money you're going to lose. It's really something you should know before you go. So this course is called Herbal Manufacturing Legal Considerations. And if you go to naturalnurse.com calendar, you'll see the sign up for that. It does offer CEUs for professionals as well, and anyone can take it. Then in March, we're starting our yearly class called Natural Nurse Herbal Certification, and that is a full course. It is live online, but if the times aren't good for you, everything is archived. And it takes you through the basics of natural medicine. It does give you 18 CEU credits for those who want CEU credits. And also all of these classes, if you are interested in becoming what's called an RH, which is a registered herbalist through the American Herbalist Guild, all of these classes grant you that. While you're at naturalnurse.com, you can sign up for the newsletter by just putting in your email and nothing else. So, you know, that's a really good way to stay in touch. So we have a wonderful guest today, and we're going to bring him on board. We're going to be talking about his new book called The Lotus and the Bud, Cannabis Consciousness and Yoga Practice. What a beautiful name. And Christopher Killam has been our guest before because he's been so involved as a really top teacher and researcher in indigenous medicine in particular and natural medicine. And he has taught yoga, meditation, and natural health since 1971. And he is known as the Medicine Hunter. You may have seen him on the Dr. Oz Show, on CNN, in the New York Times, and many other top media outlets. And his organization, Medicine Hunter Incorporated, has conducted medicinal research in more than 45 countries across five continents and the South Pacific. He is the author of many articles and 15 books, including The Five Tibetans. He lives up in Massachusetts. I imagine he's snowed in today. We'll ask him. And on today's show, we'll discuss his newest book called Lotus Bud. Thank you so much for joining us today, Chris.
Okay, so Ellen, are you not hearing me?
Now I am. Now we are. Yep, okay. We're on. Great. So I just introduced you, Chris. Now we're hearing you. I guess you unmuted and you're on Skype. And are you snowed in up there today in Massachusetts?
Yeah, we are, although we haven't gotten what New York got. You know, New York really got pounded. We only got about 10 inches or so, although we're scheduled to get more today. But, you know, that doesn't qualify as a big storm. We just call it snow. So, you know, it's really funny, you know. You might recall this in 1978, we had one of the largest snowstorms in history, and the weather people have been trying, you know, have been desperately wanting that again ever since. And, you know, so we get these exaggerated reports, for the most part, they don't really ever come true. So, but I do understand that there's, you know, quite serious snow and flooding in the New York, New Jersey area, and obviously feel sorry for people who are going through that there, but we're fine.
Well, good. All right. Everybody, we're freezing in Florida because it is 50. You know, we have our long johns on. So
that's t-shirt weather. That is t-shirt weather. I don't even wear a jacket when it's 50, for goodness sake.
It's really funny. But you have written so many books, Chris. Your books are instructive and excellent and on a variety of topics. But I would say all of them bring in the aspect of spirituality.
Well, yes. I mean, I really do live according to spiritual principles. I mean, it doesn't mean that I do everything well or right, but they've always been my guiding principles. So whether I'm thinking about researching medicinal plants in the field, which, as you know, I do all over the world, or whatever it might be, I really always have a sense of spiritual purpose and try to reflect that in my work. So, you know, thank you for saying so.
And we've discussed with you many different kinds of topics, but today we're going to focus on your latest book, which is called The Lotus and the Bud. How did you come to that title?
Well, I have been practicing yoga daily for about 51 years, and I have been personally familiar with cannabis for a few years longer than that. And, I'm aware, very aware, that the tradition of the blending of the two goes back into antiquity in India and China, Southeast Asia, and other places. And it really is part of spiritual traditions. You know, we also see that with the ecstatic traditions in the Middle East. And as cannabis yoga has emerged as something popular, I thought, you know, it would be really a wonderful thing to write a book that is deeply informed, that goes maybe a bit further into cannabis and yoga and an understanding of how the two work together in the body and the mind than others have done. And so it was sort of a, you know, ideal for me because of my experience and ideal for the times because this is now a popular thing.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because I believe a law just passed in Congress recently. I don't know if it passed, but I know it passed in the House. I'm not sure it ever got through the Senate. But of actually decriminalizing marijuana federally, which is a step that has still not actually been taken.
Right, right. And you know, we've certainly been hopeful about this for quite a while. I mean, my wife and I live in Massachusetts, and we've had medical cannabis for many, many years, and we've had so-called recreational, or what I like to refer to as adult use cannabis, for a few years. So, you know, really, you know, in our state and in other states that have adopted similar types of programs, you know, we're basically free. We grow, you know, we can bring it to parties, we can share it with friends. There's no issue with that. But the federal change, when it happens, and it will at some point, it hasn't quite happened yet, would be huge. And it would mean that we would be entirely removing cannabis from a lot of illegal activity, you know, tied in with the drug cartels, you know, really just sort of set this plant that should never have been restricted in the first place, really set it free again, as it used to be prior to the 1930s.
So 1930s is not that long ago. You know, that's not like saying that this was an illegal substance going back in history, because it wasn't.
Right. Well, we had the, look, we had the Turkish hashish pavilion in the, what was it, the 1918 World's Fair. And, you know, fathers, mothers, sons, daughters, you know, people young and old went there and had hashish candies and confections and drinks of different kinds. And then, you know, once they were good and loaded on hash, they went around to the amusements and the exhibits. And it, you know, I've not been able to find any instance or record of people having a bad time. We know that cannabis was very widely distributed by companies like Squibb and Park Davis up until Prohibition. And really, all that should happen is that it should be restored to full legal status. And, you know, I'm hoping that that will happen within the next few years.
Well, you threw out one of the many uses, which is medicinal, because I even have in my collection of old medicine bottles, and they're not that old, you know, like they're from the 1920s, where cannabis actually was the third most highly prescribed medicinal, and also in cough syrups for children. You see it right in the advertisements and magazines, and of course, bottles in every drugstore.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, there was a famous confection from the 1860s that went into the early 1900s called Gunjawala Maple Candy. And it was a hashish-based confection. And presidents and generals and statespeople and judges and doctors all extolled its virtues. I mean, Robert E. Lee, who now is, you know, quite disgraced, but he said he wished he could put a tin of it in the pocket of every Confederate soldier. This is something that was very widespread. It's actually hard for us to imagine because of the crushing restrictions that were placed on cannabis, but I do think we're seeing the end of that tunnel, end of that dark time, and I hope that that also means that all of the people who've been unjustly incarcerated and disproportionately people of color are promptly released.
Yeah, that is so totally horrendous. And I recently attended a class which talked about prohibition. And it was actually, I live on the North Shore of Long Island in Oyster Bay when I'm in New York, which is only in the summer months, nonetheless. There's these giant estates there. And this program was about the secret taverns and boat dock locations, so that these giant estates of course, the rich and famous, got their alcohol delivered all during Prohibition.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, we've seen, I mean, I first became familiar with cannabis in terms of personal use when I was 15. So that's a long time ago. And from that time up until a few years ago, we had to be careful. We had to, you know, pay attention to where we were, who was around us. You know, we were surreptitious about use. It didn't stop us. It didn't stop the flow of cannabis. It didn't stop a huge, huge supply chain. But it was the case that we had to be very careful about doing that. And now, in many states, we don't have to be careful about it. I mean, I grow in my yard. And, you know, it's free and legal to do so here. And I think that's a massive behavioral change. And, you know, when people can be rid of the fear and paranoia of something terrible happening to them because they're utilizing cannabis for whatever purpose they choose, when they can be rid of that fear, that in and of itself is good medicine.
That's true. And now, let me ask you this. You talk a lot about spirituality in your book, The Lotus and the Bud, and we'll talk about cannabis and consciousness and yoga practice. But in terms of, perhaps you know, perhaps you don't know, what they said in the Prohibition lecture that I went to was that there's alcoholism is still, you know, a terrible disease, but that there was not necessarily a decrease in alcoholism because of Prohibition, nor was there an increase in alcoholism because alcohol is widely available. Are there any stats like that in terms of the use of marijuana?
Well, I mean, first of all, the rate of alcohol-associated deaths went up very sharply during Prohibition, and that was due to actually a government program to poison alcohol supplies with wood alcohol. And so there was a huge number of deaths that happened during that time as a result of toxic alcohol. In the whole history of humanity, we don't have a single documented case of anybody ever dying from cannabis. There's no record of it anywhere in the world. So we're really in a very different place. I mean, I think that people who utilize cannabis to excess have done so during the time of Prohibition and will continue to do so during the time of legalization. But we don't have to be equally concerned about rates of death because we haven't seen even one in all of known human history.
Wow, that's a powerful statement.
Yeah.
So where there certainly are many people whose deaths are linked directly to alcohol, I mean, the physical use of it,
right,
in terms of liver cirrhosis, let alone if you look at things like traffic accidents, et cetera, you're saying that there's actually no established link to death through the use of marijuana.
There has not been a single case that we know of or that anybody can cite. And, you know, the way I think about this, Ellen, is that all of the other rules apply, okay? I mean, let's say you choose to utilize cannabis. You still have to drive carefully when you get out and drive. You still have to be responsible to your family. You still have to keep it out of the reach of children. You still shouldn't do dangerous things if you feel that you're less coordinated than you might otherwise be. You know, I mean, all of those rules still apply, but I think that there are a great many people in our society who choose to, you know, enjoy cannabis in a responsible way. And that's nothing but good news. And you know, I listened to Snoop Dogg on an interview, and he said a kind of an amazing thing the other day. He said, you take 100 brothers who don't even like each other and put them in a room with a bunch of ganja. In about an hour, they're all going to be taking selfies together. You take three brothers, put them in a room with a bottle of alcohol, one of them's going to die.
Yeah, that's often true. It definitely brings out more aggression. So, you know, it's also interesting in how, why that whole, well, I think you probably know, as I remember, seeing that little movie called Reefer Madness.
Oh, yes.
Which was linked to, you know, the vast prohibition of various substances, including marijuana.
Yeah, actually, that was initially a religious film called Tell Your Children. It's a very lurid film, as you'll recall, about, you know, people having pot parties and behaving in crazy and aberrant ways. And then one guy goes on a vicious murder spree. You know, we watch him just sort of melt down and lose his mind and become a psychotic on camera. And then that was somewhat redone and put out as Reefer Madness, you know, as government propaganda. And I think that the, you know, the problem with that film, besides that it was wholly untrue, was that it was so exaggerated that it really did come off as a comedy. When I was a kid, I guess when I was around 10 or so, Ellen, I was living in the suburbs outside of Boston. And a local radio station announced that they were going to have a special program one evening that week. They were going to broadcast from a pot party, and they'd made some arrangements with these people, you know, not to disclose the location. And I listened to that program. I was interested. I wondered what it was about. And the thing that impressed me, and I remember it to this day, was listening to these people who were apparently enjoying themselves, who didn't sound crazy, who didn't sound irresponsible. And I thought, huh, you know, that sounds pretty good, pretty good, actually. So I think a lot of the information that came out did not serve the purpose of scaring people off.
Wow, that is so true. Well, a wonderful background that you have, Chris. Let's talk about what made you be the medicine hunter, where you travel the world really researching what people use to help them feel well.
Well, I can kind of trace it back to when I was 15. I was for a couple of years in a boarding school in Massachusetts. And the first year I was there, they offered a special project, this two-week project in Puerto Rico, to basically go do good works. We were going to paint a church and do some other things in a small little country community, you know, far away from the city. And I was one of the kids that got to go on that. And I remember being there and just looking around at the lush tropical foliage and feeling the warm breeze and going to the ocean and going, I want to do this. I want to do this kind of thing for the rest of my life. And, you know, only a couple of years later, I started to become interested in herbs, though I knew nothing about them, Ellen. I was not informed. And at that time, as you know, in the late 60s and early 70s, there wasn't a ton of information around for lay people. So it was a slow process. But as I became more fascinated with botanicals and aware that they came from all over the world, I had a strong desire to, you know, go see for myself. And so those early seeds of interest and being fortunate to run into some people who were better informed than I was and influential really moved me in the direction of medicine hunting. And, you know, after working in the natural products scene in retail and manufacturing and lecturing around the country for many years, in 1994, I was invited to be the herbal advisor on a trip to China. Some people
well,
wanted
I want
to
you to hold that thought minute, and then we're going to come back and continue that, because fascinating discussion, because now we're bringing in China, we're bringing in Asian practices and all kinds of things that led you to become the medicine hunter and the author of The Lotus and the Bud, Cannabis, Consciousness, and Yoga Practice. We will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Zig.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the folklore, history, chemistry, and medicinal applications of the common kitchen herb, thyme.
The common culinary spice known botanically as Thymus vulgaris is only one member of a large genera which includes over 400 species and even more varieties. The Thymus genera is originally native to the Mediterranean region and is a perennial plant which grows wild in usually dry, sandy soil, green heaths, and grasslands. Thyme is a prolific, fragrant, creeping ground cover and often displays an attractive spray of flowering branchlets spanning the spectrum from white to violet.
There is considerable debate amongst historians as to the origin of the name thyme. Some believe it to be from the Greek thymen, meaning to fumigate or to burn a sacrifice, because it was used as a sweet-smelling incense and also to keep pests and venomous creatures away from the Greek home. Others believe it came from the Greek thumos, meaning courage or energy, perhaps because it has a reputation of being used by Greek warriors for courage and was bathed in and used as a beverage for invigoration. The Egyptians used an herb called thyme, which we believe is Thymus vulgaris, to mummify their dead. The principal chemical constituents of thyme are the volatile oils consisting of phenol, thymol, and carvacrol. A 1977 article in the scientific journal Chemical Abstracts revealed that thymol's antimicrobial activity is 18 times more powerful than phenol. Phenol is a major antiseptic used in commercial germicidal cleaners like Lysol. Thymol is one of the most potent antimicrobial substances known and far surpasses even the strongest antibiotics. It has been illustrated in the Journal of Chemistry and in the Merck Index of Drugs and Chemicals to destroy parasites, worms, fungi, bacteria, mosquito larvae, and many viruses.
The pharmaceutical and cosmetic industry is privy to the important medicinal effects of oil of Thymus vulgaris. It is ubiquitously found in gargles, cough drops, vapor rubs, and many mouthwashes. Oil of thyme is to be used, albeit very sparingly because of its potency, as a gargle or mouthwash for sore throats and inflamed gums. Because the volatile oil is expelled via the lungs and kidneys, naturopathic physicians use it for upper respiratory infections and urinary tract infections. If you're in the midst of a cold and are lying in bed with too much thyme on your hands, try making a thyme tea made with just a few teaspoons of thyme to a cup of boiling water. It's an excellent diaphoretic because it causes the body to perspire profusely. Thyme also possesses an excellent carminative and antispasmodic effect, helping in poor digestion, flatulence, and intestinal gripe.
So, listeners, if you're feeling ill, thyme heals all wounds. Remember to reach for that thyme in a bottle the next time you open up the Natural Medicine Chest.
Welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Go to naturalnurse.com and take a look at calendar. Join us for our up-and-coming classes such as dowsing for dosing. How do you decide how much of any herb that you're going to use for how long and when for yourself and others? Dowsing for dosing is the answer. And we also have one called Herbal Manufacturing, Legal Considerations, Know Before You Go. It's almost like saying, well, I'm just going to drive. I don't have to take a driver's ed class. Oh, those red lights hanging around, I don't know what to do with them. Who knows? I'll just go through them. And you go through them all the time, no problem. But when you get stopped saying, oh, I didn't know you're supposed to stop for a red light, not going to help you. So I strongly recommend that you learn about the laws. Whether or not you agree with them, it's a good thing to know. And talking about laws and substances and herbs, our guest today is author and master herbalist Christopher Killam, and he's the author of many, many books. Today we're talking about his latest wonderful book called The Lotus and the Bud, cannabis consciousness and yoga practice. And Chris, you were telling us about how you became the Medicine Hunter, which is the best place to find you at medicinehunter.com.
Well, yes, Ellen, just to kind of complete the story that I started and be brief about it, I wound up as part of a project in China in 94. And I was very fortunate to go to some remote places in the northeast of China and to see a great many things, meet many herbal experts. And when I came back, I said to myself, gee, you know, I could organize things like this very easily. It would be no problem to do. And pretty much as soon as I thought that, I was contacted by a very large company that wanted me to be an advisor for them. And that led me to a 21-year engagement, traveling all the world on their behalf, investigating botanicals on most continents, speaking all over the world, meeting herbal experts all over the world, and of course doing lots and lots of media to get the word out about natural plant-based medicine.
So this is something that comes up sometimes in terms of legal aspects as well. If you as the medicine hunter are introduced to a medicinal herb, let's say by a tribal leader, because you met many of them, and then you bring that back and it becomes a big hit commercially, is there any compensation that goes back to that original source?
Well, the compensation goes back to them always, yes. If, for example, I mean, when I first went to Vanuatu, South Pacific in 1995 to investigate kava, I was one of the people that helped to start the international kava trade. And that meant by definition that the kava growers in Vanuatu would be the ones deriving the income from that trade. And, you know, initially the income was, okay. It was better than what they'd had before, but it wasn't great. And now, today, 25 years later, it's really spectacular. And I don't think that spectacular is where we get to in all projects, but my whole idea is to find, you know, a source of kava or cat's claw or whatever it might be, and then to work with native people so that the chain of trade is environmentally sustainable. That is, we're not trashing the forest or whatever environment we're working in, and not wiping out the supply, and that the people get wages that are fair and reasonable and that can help to keep them from living in poverty, because most of the people who work on the field side in the herbal world and the spice world do live in poverty. And so I get to help to design these chains of trade, and excuse me, in that manner, you know, really help to make sure that people don't get screwed, because native people all over the world have been repeatedly screwed by folks who come in, find something that they like, and then steal that knowledge and provide no compensation. I completely abhor that way of behaving, and I don't ever do that.
So that's so great, because it's a win-win situation, both to the plant population, because you're supporting the native people who are gathering it. It makes sense for them to do sustainable practices rather than go there and pull it all out and sell it, and then next year there isn't any.
It does. And of course, the difficulty sometimes is that something becomes very popular in the market. You know, I remember in 1996 when St. John's wort became just massively popular as an antidepressant and everybody was selling it. The problem was that the tonnage of St. John's wort that was in products on the market vastly exceeded the tonnage of St. John's wort that had been grown and harvested, which meant that a lot of people weren't getting St. John's wort. They were getting something else. They were getting an adulterated product or some other herb, you know, that was made to look yellow. And so we do have difficulties. You know, if demand outstrips supply, then people can and sometimes do behave poorly from an environmental standpoint. But that's where going back to projects again and again and again and reinforcing positive sustainable trade makes a difference. I don't prefer to go to places once. I mean, I've done that many times, but I like to work on projects ongoing and develop real relationships because I think that's key to the success with this kind of business.
So now bringing the discussion back to marijuana, hemp, and we can talk about what the difference is between those two things, your book, The Lotus and the Bud, Cannabis Consciousness and Yoga Practice. And as our listeners can see, this is a huge topic. And you do want to get the book because although we can't talk about everything that's in it, Chris has fantastic recipes in here, as well as very specific yoga practices with Chris himself being the yogi model. It excellently executed and fairly easy kinds of asanas and positions that can be used. So there's really a lot going on in this book, Chris. It's beautifully done. But let's talk about now, we don't have to go far afield to foreign countries and to Kathmandu or anything like that to find some pretty massive marijuana growing fields right here in the United States.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, and I do want to say, I never call it marijuana. That's
okay,
a slang term.
Why.
No. Well, that's a slang term that was developed by Henry Anslinger, the guy who was really responsible for cannabis prohibition. And the whole idea was to make it sound like a brown-skinned Mexican product that was being used to seduce white women. That was really the repeated story. And so I pretty much avoid saying marijuana. But in any case, you know, we have huge cultivation of cannabis in the United States.
So wait, so I want to know now, what would be a good word to differentiate between what now is very huge in the marketplace being called hemp, which has very low THC levels, versus something that would also contain THC? Sometimes that's called marijuana. So what would be a good term?
Well, What I use, whether other people like it or not, for psychoactive cannabis, I use the term ganja, which is an old term for it. And for hemp, I use hemp.
Right. I understand the hemp part.
Yeah.
So I need a different term because ganja, you know, I don't see where that reflects any more, any less negatively than marijuana, other than you explain the history of developing. Anyway, when you find something good, let me know. But yes, you certainly can call it ganja because that's an ancient term.
Yeah, and it's also not pejorative and it's not racist and it doesn't in any way speak negatively toward any particular ethnic group or people of color. So I think there is a big difference. But that aside, you're right that the cultivation of cannabis is huge in the United States. And now, as you know, much more of it is legal. And that's just good news, you know, taking that pressure of imprisonment off of many people.
Absolutely. And it's become a big thing. I will say, even here in the state of Florida, where what we're up to is legal use for medical, but also then, as you know, are coming in all these growing regulations. So it's actually becoming more and more a regulated farm activity. And here in Florida, where we had a terrible blight of the orange trees that has been going on for several years and has wiped out whole orange groves, they have been replacing that mostly with hemp growing, which is the low THC.
Right. And you know, hemp has a long, long history of use going back. I mean, we can track hemp use back 12,000 years or so, although we can track hemp back millions of years through pollen sampling. So we know that hemp has been an important part of the growth and development of human culture for fiber and cordage and so many things. And of course, hemp seed was a staple food across all of Europe for centuries. It was as common as oatmeal. It was what people ate. And you know, we saw a decline in that practice, but the plant is remarkably versatile, and you know, there are a great many people out there who don't choose to get high. It's not an experience they want to have, but they can still benefit greatly from, you know, CBD-rich hemp oil that is crushed from the stalks and flowers and seeds of the plant, and still get, you know, significant relaxing benefits, improvement in sleep, a good boost to the immune system, harmonization between other systems. So, you know, the versatility of this just goes on and on.
It is. And I'm a very active member in the American Cannabis Nurses Association.
Uh-huh.
And that is a really excellent repository that also the public can access, where we have lots of wonderful references. And what you're talking about is so fascinating, Chris, because there's something that has been discovered that you're probably aware of, where there's actually a syndrome called endocannabinoid deficiency, because we're finding our own body produces this, a very similar chemical structure as does cannabis.
Well, yes. I mean, our bodies produce two cannabinoids, and they do so as a result of what's called a cascade from the fats that we consume. If the fats that we consume are not healthy fats, then we don't necessarily produce enough cannabinoids to satisfy the entire system of receptors in our bodies and brains that are that are responsible for actually being attached to by cannabinoids. So supplementing those cannabinoids with outside sources, with exogenous sources from cannabis, is a good and healthy and desirable thing, and it does support improved overall mental and emotional well-being and cardiovascular function and reproductive function and so many different things. So the discoveries of the benefits of cannabinoids and how they work with different organ systems just keep getting discovered. I was for 9 years a host on Fox News Health in 100 countries, and when Ethan Russo first came out with his proposal, Dr. Ethan Russo, who's one of the real bright lights in the field of cannabis, when he came out with the whole idea of endocannabinoid deficiency, I wrote an article and also did a TV segment for Fox called "Are You Cannabis Deficient?" And what was interesting about that time was that was still during the time when Fox was allowing comments on all articles and on videos. They subsequently stopped doing that. But I got hundreds of appreciative comments from people. Thank you so much for explaining this. I didn't get anything negative at all. And that told me that we had really turned a corner in terms of people's acceptance of this plant and its benefits.
It is pretty amazing that right in our bodies there are endocannabinoid type receptors. I mean, who put it there, right? So it's part of the natural environment of our own bodies.
Right, right.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I'd love to see that piece. Is it still posted anywhere?
If you were simply to Google, "Are you cannabis deficient?" You would almost certainly get that Fox hit first. You might get it off of my website, medicinehunter.com. That might be the first hit. I don't know, you know, what the SEO is of it, but it could come directly from Fox. But you'll find it for sure.
Wow, that's an excellent thing.
In fact, on one interview with Dr. Manny Alvarez, who for many years was Fox's primary medical doctor, I basically said, in the interview, look, cannabis is safe. We all know it is. We all know it's fine. I went through, you know, a lot of the science. And then subsequently, many people in the cannabis world came out with social media posts. Fox finally admits that cannabis is safe. And it'd been me, you know, saying that. So you never know how these messages get out there.
That is amazing. Well, we're right up to where we're going to take a little break right here so that Progressive Radio Network can tell you about some other fantastic other shows that go on here. And then we will be right back with more from our guest, Christopher Killam, about his book, The Lotus and the Bud, Cannabis Consciousness and Yoga Practice. And find out more at medicinehunter.com. And we'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we are back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Send us a shout out at naturalnurse.com. Click on calendar to see all the up and coming classes or visit us on Facebook at Facebook, The Natural Nurse. Today, we are with our guest, Christopher Killam, and we're talking about The Lotus and the Bud, his newest book, Cannabis, Consciousness, and Yoga Practice. Chris, let's move into the consciousness and yoga practice portion of your book. What do you share with us there?
Well, basically, I make the case that cannabis and yoga have been very closely aligned for thousands of years in different traditions in the East, and that there is benefit to putting the two together. What I find, and I'm certainly not the only one who finds this, is that yoga, you know, in and of itself anyway, is, among other things, a process of expansion and enhanced and elevated awareness. And when you apply a bit of cannabis, and I'm not talking about getting hopelessly stoned, you know, doing 7 bong hits or something like that, but when you utilize some cannabis and practice yoga, you get an amplification of sensation, a greater sense of expansion, a greater sense of openness. Often people find that they feel less pain or discomfort when they're practicing maybe some difficult postures. And so I go to great care to describe in The Lotus and the Bud the history of this, and also how it works in terms of the nervous system, which is largely affected by yoga practice, and the endocannabinoid system, what we were talking about before, our receptors throughout our entire bodies that respond to the cannabinoids in cannabis, how these fuse together in this practice to enhance the practice overall. And I also give people specific guidelines for practice so that if they choose to, they can not only use the book as a somewhat definitive reference for this particular approach, but also to begin a practice.
So do you have sort of that chapter, Practicing Lotus and Bud Yoga, do you have that in a video format at all?
At present, I do not, and I would like to, and I probably will. I'm just finishing up this week. I'll be finishing up the audio recording of the book and getting some final edits of that done. And I am probably going to turn my attention to producing the yoga part of The Lotus and the Bud on video.
You also have a wonderful little section on complementary herbs besides cannabis sativa. You're talking about ashwagandha, rhodiola, maca, schisandra chinensis, and panax ginseng. What made you choose those herbs out of the thousands of herbs that I know you know well to be complementary and included in the book, The Lotus and the Bud?
Well, there's something about those particular botanicals. They're all very, very safe. They are all what are known as adaptogens. That is, they help us to adapt to all forms of physical and mental stress, and they all make you feel good. And so you're right, Ellen. I mean, I am well aware, as are you, of many, many hundreds of botanicals, and I've investigated them. But for the purposes of complementing the practice of yoga and cannabis, I've really chosen the adaptogens. I have a few decades of experience blending all of this together, you know, the yoga, the cannabis, and different adaptogens, ashwagandha, panax, ginseng, schizandra berry, maca, rhodiola rosea, and sharing that with friends. And so I just thought, in terms of giving people something broader beyond cannabis itself, that I would include those because they definitely enhance the overall experience.
We also find that in their realm of active constituents, they often do also contain things that actually fit into the endocannabinoid receptor sites, and even an herb like echinacea does too, because it has anandamide. So it's interesting how all these things really fit together.
Well, they do. And you know, real yoga practice, I mean, one of the scriptures I like says, a yogi must know the medicines. Real yoga practice goes way beyond bending and stretching. You know, that's actually the least of it, in fact. But meditation and the postures and breathing and dietary practices and behavioral principles and the utilization of different botanicals, all of this, and sharing company with like-minded people, all of this is part of authentic yoga practice. And so I try to be true to that holistic way of thinking. You know, I understand that things change greatly, that most people are not practicing in a monastery or an ashram, and nor should they. These are different times. But we can carry forward into our modern practice many of the activities that are already known to work well, and certainly utilizing other botanicals that are healthy and that affect many of the functions of the body, as those herbs do, just seems right and appropriate.
I found your choices interesting, because even right here on my table where I do all this work from nowadays that we're inside, you know, so much and linked to Zooming and those kinds of things, I actually have all those herbs as a liquid extract right on my table here, because they are ones that I use. I won't say daily. I have lots of different herbs, and I might use dowsing to decide which one might be best for me today, or just intuitively use some days and some another day, but they really help to maintain a state of balance, even through stressful and difficult times.
Yes, yes. And they all happen to help to reduce cortisol, a primary stress hormone in the blood, and bring it down to a normal, healthy level. So that's also something that, you know, when people are seeking ease and openness and a greater sense of comfort in yoga practice, that's something that helps with that.
Well, those are all excellent reasons for people to get the book, The Lotus and the Bud, Cannabis, Consciousness, and Yoga Practice, a beautiful combination that Chris Killam shares with us, although certainly didn't make up. He's just recounting the ancient historic practices that have been used in human civilizations throughout the world, and he is certainly an expert in throughout the world with all the traveling and documentation he has done. So thank you so much for writing this wonderful book.
Oh, thank you, Ellen. And I really appreciate your gracious comments. And I love the work that you do spreading the word about natural health. I think you really make a valuable contribution.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you, listeners, for joining us once again for another edition right here on Progressive Radio Network on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We'd like to invite you to visit our website at naturalnurse.com. You can find Chris at medicinehunter.com. And we love your comments and feedback, and hoping that all of you, on behalf of myself and my co-host, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, stay healthy.